The world, my friends, no longer submits to the ancient resignation. That which has been is that which shall be. And that which has been done is that which shall be done. In wattle huts along the rice paddies of the world, the sun-baked kraals of Africa, men now expect better things in life than threadbare clothing, bare cupboards, and the comforts of religion. This restlessness for a better life has been called a revolution of rising expectation. The phrase is apt, and the urgency it describes well nigh universal. For there is today in our globe hardly a hamlet tucked away in some mountain fastness which has not seen a jeep, a plane, a hypodermic needle, or thumbed the pages of some picture news magazine. The world knows that there is a better way of life. The world wants the advantages of that way of life. And our world is impatient for those advantages. And yes, we can play Hanukkah to these dreams. We have the knowledge and the know-how to engineer an abundant society. The problem is this, that we cannot wrap up the package for this festival or the next or the next. There are many countries on our globe which will not enjoy the blessings of the 20th century in the 20th century. You cannot overnight convert a feudal, land-based society into a prosperous mass production society of our scientific age. Hence, the hope and the frustration, the restlessness and the surging violence which are the hallmarks of today's political life. Men have shrugged off the ancient fatalisms, the sophistic philosophies, the religions of resignation which taught them to accept, to be passive, and to be resigned. The throats of men cry out with a millennial thirst which they want to quench today from the fountain of blessing. And so they have little patience with reasonable government and a reasonable rate of progress. And they listen to the blandishment of the demagogue who promises them the impossible. And they sing in mobs and they chant hate through the streets of their cities when they become overly impatient, when tomorrow must be today. And they accept the word of the communist, who says that he will trample upon human decency and upon human dignity, all to provide them now, or tomorrow at least, with a basic minimum of some economic advance. Violence, mob rioting, tyranny, anarchy. The headlines of our newspapers to which we have become accustomed will be the daily fare in our world for many years to come. And I'm afraid that all of us must resign ourselves to this fact. There will be many another Congo, many another achievement of political independence which leads only to political anarchy. There will be many another Korea, saved for the Western world at the price of a Western military dictatorship. There will be many a tyranny imposed upon freedom, many a rate of economic progress thwarted because of the over-enthusiasm and the overly active appetites of the people. And there will be many men and many families who will be destroyed by urbanization and by industrialization because they will not be able to accommodate their values and their character to the corrosive strains of urban living. Need we despair? Need we despair because economic advance in Iran or in Egypt has led to the feudal political leadership of a Nasser or Qasem? Need we despair because independence in Guinea and Ghana has led to a raging nativism? Need we despair because a revolution for independence in Cuba has led to Castro? We need not applaud any of these changes, but equally we need not despair. The revolution of the 20th century, which will touch every bit of the fabric of human life, is in being. It is inevitable. And if it is unpredictable in its process, the conclusion can be foreseen. The French Revolution began an economic reaction among the middle class to the anachronistic restrictions of a landed aristocracy. It began with Voltaire. It began with a noble and gentle philosophy. Liberty, equality, fraternity. And it ended? It ended with the bloodbath of the terror. It ended with the guillotine. And after the guillotine, it ended with Napoleon and with tyranny. But after Napoleon came the French Republic. And after the tyrannies of our world will come the republics and the democracies of our world. For if order must be established on chaos, if order can bring prosperity, automated machinery, schoolrooms, apartment cities. It will ultimately turn men's minds from their pocketbooks to their hearts, to the needs of the spirit. And men will be impatient then with such tyrannical governments as deny them their liberties and their rights. Napoleon himself strangely knew this. I reread recently his diary, and in it he makes this sensitive prophecy. "I am the signet," he wrote, "which marks the end of a page in the French Revolution. When I die, the page will be turned, and the revolution will resume its course." The dictators of our world are not immortal. Tyrants will die, and when they do, the aborted revolutions of our world will run their course. And we must remember this too, that we stand at the beginning, in the period of the first chapter of this worldwide revolution. And the beginning is convulsive. We know what we have left behind. The cruelties of the past, its injustices and inconsistencies, its economies of scarcity, its governments of class and of privilege. But we are not yet sure where we are heading, what it is that the new society will be, how it can be described, how human rights must be defined, how economies can progress. And so we move by jerks, by fit and start. So occasionally we fail and we stumble. But the machines are being made and the factories are being built and the classrooms are being staffed and the hospitals are being equipped and the apartment cities rise. Tomorrow, a grand and glorious tomorrow will come. And I think that most Americans, you and I, despite our concern for the shedding of blood, despite our lack of sympathy for the hate-chanting mob, despite our distaste for the independence become anarchy, become tyranny, I think that most of us are in instinctive sympathy with the deeper hopes and aspirations of the revolution of the 20th century. It is our revolution. Began in the Bible, "Justice, justice shalt thou pursue, proclaim liberty unto the land." It is our revolution. We proclaimed it in our Declaration of Independence when we spoke of man's inalienable rights to life and to liberty and to the pursuit of happiness, and of men's right to alter and to abolish any government which was destructive of these rights. And as Americans, we know too the cost, personal and national, of industrialization and of independence. We paid that cost. We paid it at Valley Forge and at Gettysburg. We paid it at Haymarket Square and in the anthracite coal mine districts of Pennsylvania and West Virginia. And we are paying it today in the South. We know that the revolution of the 20th century, whose fruits we enjoy, does not come overnight, that you cannot wave a magic wand and presto, automated factories, constitutional government, adequate schools and hospitals. We know the cost. We have fought at least a good measure of the struggle. And we are sympathetic with those who are just at the moment which Professor Rostow has called the takeoff, the leaping into the 20th century. But to be sympathetic broadly is not to support. And though we have, out of this sympathy, given billions of dollars in aid as a boost, a helping hand to the emerging nations, I'm afraid that our sympathy, our attitude towards the revolution of the 20th century has been somewhat inconsistent. Soviet propaganda delights to picture the United States as counter-revolutionary, as a government interested in the vested of the privilege of the past, not in the immense promise of the future. And there is just sufficient truth in some of these charges to give us pause. How shall we account to the masses of the world for our aid to the dictators of the world? How shall we account to the masses of the world for our unwillingness until this year ever to vote in the United Nations for a resolution condemning colonialism and favoring independence? How can we account to the world for our machinations to overthrow democratically elected regimes in Laos and in Guatemala? How can we account to the world for 5 years of indecision in recognizing the independence of Indonesia? How can we account to the world for dollar diplomacy, the flag following our companies and protecting their rights? This, of course, is only a small part of the story. The United States is still today the only nation of the world to have mounted a major offensive against poverty, illiteracy, economic scarcity through our Point Four and our foreign aid and our ICA. But our attitude has been a confused one, or at best it has been inconsistent. We have somehow never been able to parse out, to separate the dimension of help to human beings in need and the dimension of the Cold War. Somehow we cannot make up our minds whether our aid is to build up an economy or to build up their military forces, to build dams or to build airfields. And out of this confusion come some of the greatest defeats for the United States in the forum of the world. Out of this confusion has come our identification with the counter-revolutionaries of the world. Let us take the little nation of South Vietnam as a case in point. It is the focus of our interest today. South Vietnam is a creation of the treaty ending the French-Indochinese War in 1954. 7 years at the end of the Second World War, the Indochinese struggled for their independence, and we were silent. And we brought no pressure on our ally, France, to grant them their independence. And little by little, what began as a revolution in the best traditions of the United States ended in a struggle between East and West, for the insurgents turned for arms to the one group of nations prepared to give them arms. And by 1953, the United States came perilously close to being involved in a war of independence on the side of the colonial power. 1954, Yuen Dinh Phu, French collapse, the partitioning of Indochina. One small segment of this nation became an independent state, South Vietnam. We were determined, and rightly so, to make of South Vietnam an economic and political showcase, evidence to the world of the sympathy of the people of the United States and their willingness to help in the revolution of the 20th century. And we forced the deposition of Bao Dai, the cruel, callous Mandarin parasite who then ruled this little nation. And we imposed and helped to impose free elections. And we sponsored with our funds and with our technical help, land reform, projects of irrigation, the building of dams, the stringing of high-tension electric wires across the nation, all brought in by Diem, the new premier. And all seemed to be going well. All seemed to be conspiring to make it possible for the United States to be identified with the hopes of the world. Then we got caught up in this tragic inconsistency. Diem in power became Diem the all-powerful. The democratic elected official began to depose others who were democratically elected and to impose members of his own family. He became tyrant. He became conservative. He became disinterested in the economic reform of his nation. Where he had ordered bricks with United States funds, he now ordered French dresses. Where he had ordered agricultural seed, he now ordered Cadillacs for his office. 40,000 political prisoners were taken. The jails were filled. The press was censored. The universities were closed down. And the United States, sympathetic to the people, the United States became identified with the tyrant. Why? If he had ruled in any of our communities, we would have had him deposed. But it is a fact of South Vietnamese life. There have always existed in the countryside small bands of guerrilla troops. And after the French Indochinese War, many of those who had been mobilized refused to lay down their arms. And in the early days of his regime, Diem was not able to force the surrender of these people. And the Viet Cong, these guerrilla forces, attracted to themselves during the last 7 years those whom Diem deposed, those whom Diem persecuted, the young intellectuals who had dreamed of a better future for their nation, those who feared his power. And they turned for support to the North, the communist state of North Vietnam, and they found that support. And now we have in South Vietnam a battle not of freedom lovers against the despot, but of West against East, and we, identified with the West, become identified with the tyrant of the East. Then the people turned against this tyrant. For the way in which our aid was distributed made it possible for inflation to take part in the capital city of Saigon. The rich had greedy fingers, and our gold stuck to their fingers. And with this gold, they bought luxuries. And with the luxuries came inflation. And with inflation, the few coppers which the farmer had were put away against his rainy day became as nothing. And the farmer saw his savings go. He knew that the programs of land reform had been shelved. He listened to the whispers of the forest, the whispers of the guerrilla. Now the people and the guerrilla were turned against us. For we had become the government in the eyes of the people. The 200,000 men of the Vietnamese army wore our uniforms. They hoisted our rifles. They shot our bullets. They were staffed by 2,000 of our officers. We had become the symbol of a hated power. Our best interests had been confused and had been thwarted. Our best instincts had somehow been shunted aside because we were confused. Because our policy has never been clear. Are we for the world revolution? For the rights of men, for the dignity of men? Or are we fearful of our own skins only? Is our only concern in granting this aid the Cold War? Nor have things changed, nor will they soon change, at least in Indochina. What then? How can we, this great peace-loving, freedom-loving nation of ours, regain the moral leadership, or at least a portion of the moral leadership which is so rightly ours? I would suggest as a first step that the United States renounces a technique of its policy, the granting of military aid and military assistance. We have, since the end of the Second World War, spent literally tens of billions of dollars to send military hardware and military know-how to the nations of the world. And not one single bullet of all of this has ever been shot in anger against a single Soviet soldier. But many are the intellectuals and the patriots and the insurgents and the discontent who have been shot by American bullets ordered by the tyrants of the world. Military assistance is a costly boomerang. Costly in the giving, and doubly so in that the identification it imposes upon us by being identified with some factor in the politics of some other foreign nation state. We cannot control the idiosyncrasies or the political ideologies of a foreign lord. But when we allow our guns, our military hardware to fall into his hand, we sustain him in power. We seem to be applauding his actions. His people cannot separate out our Cold War purpose from the warm revolution in their own country, from what seems to be our support of a man whom they misprize or hate. And if we are concerned lest the Soviet advance by conquest and sweep through the world, then let us sign mutual assistance treaties with these nations and come to their aid when a border is crossed. And if our concern is with subversion within these nations, then let us see to it that their economies are so stable and their governments so constitutional that the subversives within the nation will have no cause and will attract no masses. This is the way to identify yourself with the wave of the future, to support the tyrants of yesteryear, to ask to be frustrated, to ask to be defeated. And I would suggest also that we separate out our foreign aid from any desire for political or military assistance. Foreign aid is not a carrot held at the end of the stick. The promise which will be granted if an airfield is given us, if mercenaries are turned over to our forces. It should be given, it must be given, it will be successful only if it is a free will offering on the part of a people of abundance and of affluence to peoples who have little, who are struggling to make subsistence possible for themselves and their families. Ideally, this aid ought to be channeled through the United Nations, that it might not be identified with any ideology, that the world would know that we are giving to a world body for the good of the world, not to save our own necks and our own skins. If this is impossible, then let it at least be given with intelligence. And I speak now not only of the greasy fingers and of the hidden Swiss bank accounts and of the scandals in Laotian and Thai aid which have been brought out. I speak now of a lack of concern for the total reaction on the part of an economy to the injection of large-scale aid. Again, Vietnam is a case in point. Pouring $2 billion into Vietnam did not make the country more wealthy, but impoverished the country. For it precipitated an inflation with which the average man could not cope. Let our giving be done with intelligence. Let it be scrupulously honest. Let us demand accounting for our dollars, that on them the mandarins do not wax fat, but the masses get at least a loaf of bread. Justice Douglas of the Supreme Court, writing on this theme recently, had this to say: the United States should promote democratic revolutions against the conditions of economic feudalism. We as Democrats cannot become subversive communist style and form undergrounds within each nation, undergrounds bent on overthrow by force and violence. But we can be aligned with, not against, economic democracy. For without advances on that frontier, we can never expect to have viable democratic societies in the newly emerging nations of the world. To date, we have thrown our weight for the most part on the other side. When Guatemala showed signs of revolt, we helped install a fascist regime. When Mossadegh in Persia started basic reforms, we became alarmed. That man who I am proud to call my friend, this is Justice Douglas, was a Democrat in the La Follette Norse sense of the term. We united with the British to destroy him. We succeeded. And ever since, our name has not been an honored one in the Middle East. For the promotion of revolution on the economic frontier, our role is plain. Whenever we see a non-communist in power who has a reform program, we can throw our weight behind him. When we advance aid, we can do so only if starts are made on economic programming. An American banker never finances a project unless he sees the blueprint and is convinced it is constructive. We need not employ banker's standards, but we should employ democratic standards. Is a start being made on land reform? Will the factories to be built be worked by sweatshop labor? Will the dam to be constructed serve only the landlords? Or will the new lands coming under irrigation be opened up in small units to the peasants? Is .4 aid being extended only for the favored few? Or is it part of a program whereby large estates are broken up and sold to the peasants? Are the factories being built with American dollars to be appropriated by the ruling clique, as has happened over and over again in Formosa? Or will independent groups be allowed to bid freely and to make a start towards establishing a free enterprise society? Under Truman and Eisenhower, we asked few such questions. Our theory was that if each nation in underdeveloped areas got richer by millions each year, communism would somehow be defeated. Even irrigation projects were not conditioned on restrictions in the acreage of land that a single family might own, such as we have used with conspicuous success in our own country. Under our foreign aid, the rich in feudal societies often got richer and richer, and the poor ended by being held more tightly in the vice. The revolution of the masses for their share of the blessing of our world is in being. It is inevitable. Its course is unpredictable. Blame it if we must on the steam engine. But recognize that the engine of this revolution is hurtling down the track at full throttle, and that we dare not avoid getting aboard. And if this be true, then let us see to it that our experience with the revolution of the masses, which we have largely successfully achieved, be given to these underdeveloped nations. Let us see to it that our philosophy, the philosophy of Jefferson and of Lincoln and of Wilson, our philosophy becomes patent and self-evident to them through our example, Let us give them of our knowledge, of our techniques, of our experience. Let us not pervert our aid. Let us not destroy or taint the image of American democracy in the world. Let us separate out our Cold War military needs, which are those of massive deterrence and seldom involve the boundaries of these small nations of the world, the needs of the masses of the world. Let us help them. Let us guide them. Let us be sympathetic to them. Let us encourage them. And if we must deal with their overlords, as occasionally we must, let us show our distance and our disdain. One can deal with a competitor without clasping him to his bosom. And if we give aid, let us see that this aid results in the dams we propose and the highways we have engineered, and not in more luxurious homes for those in power, and television sets, servants, and Cadillacs. The need is great. Time is late. The world cries out for our help. We, born in revolution, we who were born to hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute a new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to seem most likely to affect safety and happiness. We, for whom this is the Declaration of Independence, cannot deny such declaration to the nations of the world. Amen.